the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. In the interest of fairness and balance, we're going to be doing today what we did last week about the Democratic National Convention. We're going to be looking at the Republican National Convention and asking what we should be looking for, what we should have noticed already, what issues are really framing the debate, what are people talking about, what should we be talking about, how should we talk about this happening with our children around the dinner table and in our workplace, on the college campus. We're going to be talking about how we as Christians should consider everything from the scripted pageantry of these political conventions to what is said and what isn't said. How do we think critically and learn together to think critically and intelligently about what's going on here? We'll be talking about that, and I'm going to have one of my favorite guests here. In fact, our favorite guest host of this program, Dr. Russ Moore, who's Dean of the School of Theology, Vice President for Academic Administration at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, head of the Carl Henry Institute for Evangelical Engagement. We're going to have a fun conversation coming up, and it's a conversation we want to invite you to join. Give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some issues in the news. I want to go first to Great Britain, where the news is that in Wales, the Reverend Dr. Geoffrey John, the Dean of St. Albans Cathedral, is to be nominated reportedly as Bishop of Bangor in North Wales. Now, normally we do not announce all episcopal appointments in the Church of England or the Church of Wales on this program, so there is something going on here, and I'll tell you what it is. Geoffrey John is the openly homosexual man who 2 years ago celebrated a civil partnership ceremony with another priest, and just before that, he was nominated to be a bishop in the Church of England, but that nomination was withdrawn by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams. But now this is a different story. In the church in Wales, Dr. Williams has no authority as Archbishop of Canterbury over the Church of Wales, and it appears that Geoffrey John, who speaks Welsh, is likely to be appointed a bishop of that church. Now, the upshot of all of this is that this would be, according to the way Anglicans count things, the third national church to have appointed a gay bishop. Now, in this case, I should say that in the Church of England, there is no openly declared homosexual bishop, but the church has taken steps toward blessing homosexual unions. But this would be a major step there in the church in Wales. According to the Times of London, Dr. John is celibate, but conservatives oppose his elevation because he has written in support of a new scriptural understanding of homosexuality. Now, very interestingly, this article is written by Ruth Gledhill, who is one of the best religion reporters in the world. She writes for the Times of London, but she does editorialize a bit in this article. I want to read to you exactly the way she wrote this paragraph. She said, despite his civil partnership with the Reverend Grant Holmes, so that's the two reverends together, she says Dr. John is celibate, but listen, I'm going to read this exactly as she wrote it. She said, but conservatives oppose his elevation because he has written persuasively in support of a new scriptural understanding of homosexuality. Now that's interesting. When you look as an informed, intelligent reader at the news, one of the things you need to look at is exactly how a reporter has written a story. Now, sometimes you're not sure that it's the reporter who's written it this way or an editor who has edited it this way, but whatever you have in the final edition of a newspaper is what those who control the newspaper want the news to be presented to be. And in this case, whether this was by Ruth Gledhill's determination or an editor's insertion, the insertion of the word persuasively here, when speaking of his writing in support of a new scriptural understanding of homosexuality, tells you not so much a great deal about Geoffrey John or even about the scripture on homosexuality, but it tells you a great deal about the Times of London. But my attention to Great Britain today is not primarily about the Times of London or even about the Reverend Geoffrey John or the Church of Wales. My attention to Great Britain today is primarily towards another British newspaper. This is The Guardian. And The Guardian has been, over the last half century or so, the newspaper most closely associated with the Labour Party, the more liberal part of the culture there, the left wing of British society. Linda Grant, writing an article on Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, has written what you almost believe could not have been written. Now, just so you know what I'm talking about here, she sets this up. She says that what the nomination of Sarah Palin as vice president on the Republican ticket means is that it exposes, quote, two opposing sides of America. Now, I'll be writing about this on my website at albertmuller.com in terms of the reemergence of some of these issues, and I would argue the inevitable reemergence of some of the cultural issues, some of the moral issues of debate in the course of a presidential campaign. But this divide we've talked about, whether you want to identify it, as we talked about yesterday on this program, as a culture war, or you want to talk about it on different terms, however you describe it, there is a conflict of visions. There is a basic cleavage of worldviews. But listen to how she writes this, and just get ready for this. This is Linda Grant writing in The Guardian today. I quote, "So clear is the divide between big city and small town America that one American friend said to me, 'These white bread Republicans are like children. Someone has to tell them what to do and what to think. They're incapable of independent ideas.' The conviction by the left that the right is stupid is one of the defining and least attractive characteristics of contemporary politics. Assuming that anyone who disagrees with you is too dim to get your point is not itself a particularly brainy way to win others over to the essential correctness of your views. But it is true that to small-town Republicans, the world is not a complicated place because they have seen so little of it," end quote. Now, just take that paragraph for a moment. Just assume that you don't know anything about America. You don't know anything about liberals or conservatives. You don't know anything about big-city people, as they're described here, or small-town people. All you know is the English language. Okay? So follow what she does in this paragraph. She says, "It isn't smart to argue that your opponents are dumb." But then she follows that up immediately by saying, "Nevertheless, it is true that to small-town Republicans, the world's not a complicated place," which is to say, Republicans, also known as conservatives in this story, are basically unintelligent. Why? Because they've seen so little of the world. This is what she says. "I ask a sophisticated and well-traveled Republican why he voted the way he did. He described growing up dirt poor in a small town in Northern California, where joining the military was your sole ticket out, where the people in his family who depended on welfare stayed where they were, and the ones who worked their fingers to the bone managed to make a better life for themselves. For him, joining the Army led directly to an education. In fact, it led all the way to Princeton. But how," I ask him baffled, "because someone as intelligent as he is believed that George W. Bush was anything but a cretin. Because," he explained, "people in small towns don't like or trust intellectuals, particularly ones who appear to be sneering at them for their supposed stupidity. They admire a plain-speaking man. It's what they know and it's what they're used to. They always assumed Bush was a regular guy who could keep his thoughts concise. So America is stuck, two countries, mutually irreconcilable, who never meet each other and don't want to either, who distrust each other at best, despise each other at worst, and who have absolutely no understanding of the other." Well, this was not written even by one of our own elite newspaper reporters. It didn't appear in the Washington Post or the Boston Globe or the New York Times, Los Angeles Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. It appeared in The Guardian in London. This is how the world sees us. But just notice how, nonetheless, there is the assumption here that educated and intelligent means liberal. And even when she says that's not a smart way to frame the argument, that's how she frames the argument. She just chooses different words in order to make her case. One of the reasons why this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation is because we do want to recognize the complexities of these issues. We do want to consider the implications of convictions. We do want to understand how principle leads to policy. We want to listen carefully to what people have to say and determine whether they are actually working out of a consistent worldview. But what we are really facing here, and I think this is a great deal of what's going on in the popular culture and the backlash against the media's treatment of the vice president designate, now the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, I think what we're seeing this backlash is the recognition on the part of a lot of Americans that the people who oppose them often do so because they just consider them stupid. And this goes back to one of my favorite anecdotes about William F. Buckley Jr., who, when running for the mayoralty position in New York City, a position he lost, was once challenged as to whether he would do what John F. Kennedy did when he assumed the White House. John F. Kennedy assembled what historians have described as the best and the brightest. He said he wanted to pull together a cadre and core of public intellectuals who would frame the most intelligent responses to the nation's trouble. So he hired people like Robert McNamara, who became Secretary of Defense, and you could go on the entire list. He ransacked the Ivy League and the elites in order to find people to staff his administration. William F. Buckley was asked, "If you were elected mayor of New York City, Would you want to go to Harvard and Yale and the Ivy League in order to find those who would staff your administration? And William F. Buckley famously responded, I think the people of New York would prefer to be served by the first 300 names found in the New York City telephone directory than by the faculty directory at Harvard University. What was he saying? He was saying there is a resident wisdom on the part of the American people that is actually superior to that that is found by those who consider America to be backward and who consider simple, self-evident principles to be oppressive. That's at least part of what's going on here. Call and tell us what you think. We're going to be talking about what to look for in the Republican National Convention 2008. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Politics is not our natural beat here, but it is unavoidable right now. As a matter of fact, just in terms of the sheer volume of the news, I can just give you something of a quantitative kind of review. Every day I'm presented with stacks and stacks of materials and articles and all the things going on in the media. And in 9 out of 10 days, we have an overwhelming material base that is drawn from moral issues, cultural issues, biomedical ethics, family issues, larger cultural trends and all the rest. Well, all that's gone. And interestingly, it's not just gone basically from the American press, it's gone from the international press, because this entire drama of the American democracy has the attention of the world as well. So here we are. This is what Americans are talking about, and so that's what we're talking about today. Now, we had scheduled this program looking at the Republican National Convention there in St. Paul. We'd scheduled it earlier this week, but events intervened. And so here we are, and this is actually a good time to have this discussion, because we're able to talk about what did happen already, and we're able to look tonight to what will be the closing and climactic end of the Republican Convention when Senator John McCain delivers his acceptance speech for the 2008 Republican presidential nomination. My guest today is our dear friend, Dr. Russell Moore, a keen observer of all things political and really a very thoughtful analyst of these things. And, you know, Russ, when I think about John McCain's challenge tonight, I think of it right now, first of all, at the personal level.
Mm-hmm.
This is a man who desperately thought he ought to be delivering that address 8 years ago.
That's right. That's right. And who, in another sense, probably thought he never would get a chance to deliver it. I mean, you think about where he was this time last year, as Rudy Giuliani mentioned last night. It did not look like this was going to happen. He's pulled it off.
And I say he's pulled it off. And I just want to do a little bit of armchair analysis here for a moment. And I want to lay something out, see if you agree with it. If not, in any event, I'd love to hear your response to it. Here's the way I read it. John McCain entered the 2008 presidential race hardly the first choice of American evangelicals.
That's fair to
say. So he found his way, nonetheless, through a battle of attrition, which the primary race always is, to a dominant position. American evangelicals had to look at John McCain then, say, earlier in the spring and say, okay, it looks like this might happen. What are we going to do? Then possibility became not only probability, but inevitability when John McCain clearly had, by the time the Texas primary was over, enough delegates to win the Republican nomination. And then the question was, where's he going to come out in this? What kind of candidate is he going to be? Now, Russ, my argument is that that question persisted until the last 3 weeks. I think the turning point in this campaign was the Saddleback Civil Forum.
I agree.
I think we'll look back and see that. And
I
think his nomination of Sarah Palin was the accelerator jammed to the floor in terms of what momentum he could add to his campaign.
And I think evidence of that is the way the crowd responded last night several times when someone mentioned the pay grade comment that Barack Obama made at Saddleback about the lives of the unborn. That just so clearly, I think one of the reasons for that is that evangelicals knew Hillary Clinton. And traditionalist conservatives, they knew and they understood Hillary Clinton because of the Clinton years, but they saw Barack Obama for most of the year as kind of the Hillary slayer in the Democratic primaries. He was the one kind of driving out the corruption of the Clintons. And that's all they really thought about Barack Obama. Now you've got a very clear contrast when people are starting to see what kind of presidency would Barack Obama actually have. And then looking at John McCain and seeing the way he answered those questions at Saddleback, I think that's right. And the Sarah Palin nomination, which is not only because of the views that she holds, but because it also tended to put some life back into the Republican campaign.
Well, I think the life there is definitely directed toward the fact that she comes as one of the very few candidates who has the principles worked out in terms of her life in such a self-evident way, and especially her commitment to the dignity of every single human life. But who also has the narrative. And let's face it, Americans understand the narrative. I want to come back and say, I think the narrative is the secret to Barack Obama. Not only is he just a tremendously gifted human being.
Right.
But let's face it, you're talking about the narrative of a young man, single home, single parent home, works his way to become not only a law student at Harvard, but the editor of the Harvard Law Review, the whole thing. You can follow that through. First African-American nominee of American political party. Mm-hmm. There's a story there, and it's a compelling story, whether you intend to vote for Barack Obama or not.
That's exactly right. And I disagree with the people who are saying that doesn't work for Republicans. The last really exciting, energizing Republican candidate, Ronald Reagan, it was exactly that kind of thing. It was a personal narrative of Dixon, Illinois, all the way through. The lifeguard who does well. And that's exactly the case.
Well, let's just point out a little bit of American history. The very first Republican president was elected on the part of a narrative.
Well, that's exactly
we're talking about Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And Abraham Lincoln's narrative grew so much a part of American mythology that it sometimes gets presented in nearly incoherent ways. I'm sure you've heard about the little boy who, when asked to write his essay about Abraham Lincoln, said Abraham Lincoln was so poor that he was born in a log cabin made with his own hands.
Yeah, that's right.
And
and Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, you're seeing some of the Teddy Roosevelt themes even with Sarah Palin, with the hunter, the conservationist, the outdoorsman, the courageous man. And that's true there as well.
You know, here is a thesis to which I have long held. And I think this is a reading of human nature. I'm not even saying that this is a principled analysis. Mm-hmm. This is merely a pragmatic analysis. This is an analysis of the way I think human beings are.
Mm-hmm.
My prediction all along has been that the woman first elected on a national ticket is going to be a woman who, like Margaret Thatcher, the first and now only woman prime minister there in Great Britain, would be understood to be so strong on these issues that there could be no question as to what she would do. For instance, a time of war, no one doubted what Margaret Thatcher would do when Argentina attacked the Falkland Islands. No one doubted what Margaret Thatcher would do when members of her own cabinet defied her. I think that's what we're looking at here.
Yeah, and with Margaret Thatcher and with Sarah Palin, there's just a really fine line of somebody who maintains femininity and dignity. She's very clearly a woman. And yet at the same time, she has authority. She has heft. I think that works in a way. It didn't work with Hillary Clinton.
Well, or it might have worked in a different way. And I understand exactly what you mean. But just take the symbolism. But the symbolism between the difference between a skirt suit and a pantsuit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a very different approach. I think Hillary Clinton, by the time she got to in the midpoint of her campaign, was so stereotyped that if she had shown up in a skirt, people would have said she's a sellout.
Yeah, right, that's right. But think about the way feminists say, they point out all of the evidences in the media, people saying Hillary Clinton sounds shrill. Whether that's coming from something that's in reality there or not, nobody's saying that about Sarah Palin. She does not come across as someone who is shrill. She comes across as someone who is strong.
Yeah. She has a sense of humor, though, and I think America really didn't know that until last night.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And she delivered that speech exceedingly well.
Oh, the community organizer line was one of the most classic things I have ever heard at a political
not
convention.
Not to mention the styrofoam columns.
That's
that is not the stuff of which governance really is made. That is the stuff of which leadership and elections often made. And
that's
so,
right.
You know, we're looking at a phenomenon here. And again, when you look at the Democratic ticket, you talk about Barack Obama as a political phenom, as they say these days, a phenomenon. And you clearly have that now on the Republican side with Sarah Palin. Folks, we'd love to know what you're thinking about this, what you have observed thus far as a critical, careful, close analyst of these things. What have you observed at the GOP convention? What are you looking for tonight? How should we as Christians think about this? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the controversy that's emerged in the national media, and we're going to talk about the platform of the Republican Party. It hasn't had adequate attention in the press because of these other issues. It will here when we come back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I want to direct you at the web to an outstanding resource. Christianity Today magazine has done a comparison side-by-side of the Democratic and Republican platforms, just using the language from the platforms, and it's really edited very well. We're going to put the link up right now at the website for the Albert Mohler Program. You can go and look at that. We're going to be referring to it in just a moment. You can also, of course, print out the full copy of the platforms of both parties, but you're going to kill a tree or two by the time you do that. And this synopsis offered by Christianity Today is really worthwhile. We're going to turn to that in just a moment because there are some rather interesting things in here that you might not expect. But first, let's go to the phones. Phyllis is calling from Winter Garden, Florida. Go ahead, Phyllis.
I am so excited about Governor Pilon. I wish we could have the elections tomorrow and just see how our country is going to run. I am so excited about McCain. The platform is wonderful, and I can't wait to vote.
Okay, Phyllis, I want to ask you a question. You hang with me here for just a moment. I want to test something with you. You say you're very excited about McCain, and you mentioned Governor Palin's nomination. You mentioned the platform. Were you this excited, say, 2 weeks ago? Or has something happened between 2 weeks ago and now that has really changed your perspective on the election?
Last night happened. Mm. I am so proud to be a Republican. I called Orange County Supervisor of Elections. I'm going to go to the Republican office tomorrow in San Juan Boulevard. I want to get involved.
Well, I appreciate your call, Phyllis. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You know, there's an important principle I think we need to set out here, and that is that in a fallen world, every political allegiance is provisional and temporary. Mm-hmm. And I want to go back to Phyllis's excitement here, and I think that excitement was palpable in that convention hall last night. But when it comes to Christians whose concerns are based in principle, had the Republican Party gone in a different direction, Russ Moore, I'm going to argue that we would have been required to think completely differently about the Republican Party and its future prospects.
Yeah, and I think we always have to have a skeptical excitement, regardless of whether you resonate with a political candidate or not. You ought to always be saying, I'm watching to see whether this person is actually going to follow through on the commitments that are being made, and I'm seeing the limits to what. The worst thing that can happen is to be so enthusiastic that we think we can solve all of these problems by electing the right people. That distracts us from the mission that we've been given in Christ.
Well, I think Phyllis's excitement is reflective of a kind of relief that has come to an awful lot of people who have been looking at this election and just wondering, do we really have any kind of clear differences between the parties and between the tickets?
Yeah.
And if so, how do we understand this? And I'll tell you, for both liberals and conservatives, the nomination of Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, as the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party, it helped to make those issues very clear.
Yeah, you know, I saw a bumper sticker several months ago that said, McCain, I guess, if I have to. And I think that summed up the feelings of a lot of conservative voters, and I think that's evaporated. I think exactly for the reason she mentioned. Last night, there was a connecting with people in the experience of this woman, in the way she's able to speak in a way that's understandable. Yeah. And I just think people were able to connect with what she had to say, regardless of whether you like her. I think she clearly was able to do that.
Now, I want to come back to what I said over and over again last week and even earlier this week about these political conventions. Mm-hmm. We should not assume that a great deal of business is being done here. There's a formality of the actual taking of the vote to nominate those who will head the ticket. And be the ticket for these national offices. The conventions do nominate a president and vice presidential candidate. They do adopt platforms and do a little bit of other business, but the reality is all that could be done without the meeting. The meeting, in terms of the media event, is a scripted television program. Mm-hmm. That's true for the Democrats, and it's equally true for the Republicans. Mm-hmm. They take everything into political consideration. There are political consultants deciding what the candidates wear, how the candidates speak, what the platform, and I don't mean here the policy platform, but the speaking platform, mm-hmm. what it looks like. Mm-hmm. They calculate whether there should be Roman columns or, I guess, a giant video screen in the background.
Bad call.
All of that. It is distracting to me as well. But nonetheless, we need to have a skeptical eye, understanding that the purpose of a political party, its sole reason for existence, is to gain power. That's what political parties do. Political parties do what they believe is in the best interest of the party, or at least those who are controlling the party in terms of their own determination. So it's very interesting to look at this. And, you know, I just want, again, to repeat that as Christians, we need to be looking through an awful lot of what's out there in terms of the scripted performance beyond what the media is talking about, because they can focus on one or two issues and miss something far more important. We also need to look at this through Genesis 3 eyes, understanding that in a sinful world, politics is always a complicated process. Democracy itself is a complicated process. We need to be careful, critical, reflective, and we need to be really clear about our own principles when we enter this arena. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest here in the studio is Dr. Russell Moore. We're glad to have him, as always, for talking about not only tonight at the Republican National Convention and what we should be thinking about looking for, but what's happened over the last few days and what the conversation and controversy about it really does represent. We're going to turn to the platform in just a moment. But I want to turn to Blacksburg, Virginia, where Joseph's on the line. Go ahead, Joseph.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. Thank you for having me. I am a Democrat, and I just want to say that last night, what I heard was just more of the same in terms of a lot of attacks. And we've heard of attacks from the Democratic side as well, but I also thought the attacks last night took more of a mean slash sarcastic tone, especially when we're talking about Giuliani was talking about, and also with Palin's comments as well.
Okay, Joseph, I appreciate your call, and I want to tell you, I think you're right about the sarcasm. In other words, I think it was intentional sarcasm. It's sarcasm with a smile when it came to Governor Palin, perhaps with a little less of a smile when it came to Rudolph Giuliani. Not exactly the warmest, most fuzzy character anyway. I'll simply say, evidently, the speechwriters expected that that would work in terms of communicating something, and at least in terms of people in that auditorium, it was clear that it did work. Russ Moore, what are the limits of that kind of sarcasm?
I think there are limits, but I do not think especially Palin crossed those limits. And I think the reason is because there is this kind of somber messianic feel around Barack Obama that's not wearing well with a lot of people. I think the strategy was to try to get behind that and to do it with humor. And so you almost had a contrast of Sarah Palin, who's having fun, she's having a good time, as opposed to this kind of, I mean, you think about the ending of the Barack Obama speech, and as Bill Kristol said, it sounded, the kind of music they're playing, it's like someone had died at the Politburo. It's this very serious, somber, historic moment type of thing. I think the strategy was to say, let's poke through that. And that's going to happen in every political party every year to some degree or other.
I think it's also more likely to happen when the second party has its convention, they're responding to what happened the first week. Usually they're separated by more time. But
I mean, you remember Ann Richards, for instance. Poor George. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth. I mean, that happens on both parties. And frankly, those moments are the moments people remember. For years and years to come. That's just the way it works.
Let me tell you what I think the limit of sarcasm is. Here's where I think the limit is. I think when the American people perceive anything as mean, there's an instant moral recoil. And I would just suggest that you're playing with a tinderbox here. Whenever you do something like that, you better be able to pull it off with a smile. Ronald Reagan could pull it off with a smile.
Sure.
You know, he could do that. And if I were an advisor to Barack Obama, which I decidedly am not, and he's never called me and asked for advice, there are things I'd love to talk to him about. But here's what I would advise if I were his advisor. I would say, lighten up. You know, you've got to appear to be someone who is thinking hopefully and optimistically and about yourself. You know, Ronald Reagan's humor was always self-deprecating humor.
That's right. And you know, some of the same lines that Sarah Palin used last night, John McCain couldn't use tonight. It would not go over as well. It would sound bullying and mean, but she was able to pull it off in a way that just didn't seem to be ganging up on someone.
Someone was talking about Ronald Reagan, I think it was last night, and was remarking about what happened when Ronald Reagan went to speak at Harvard University.
And
he got up before the faculty and the student body and said, you know, here you are studying at this incredible place. You're the privileged elite of America and all the rest. He said, I just think about what I might have been able to do had I been able to get a Harvard education. Of course, the man was the sitting president of the United States. So, you know, there's a certain self-deprecating humor you can get away with. There's a certain sarcasm you can get away with. But let me just point out, Richard Nixon couldn't pull off sarcasm.
That's right.
And why? Because everybody knew that he probably meant it in the most mean-spirited way.
That's exactly right. And with Sarah Palin, too, you have somebody who, for a week, has been being eviscerated by her opponents and by the media in a lot of ways. She's standing up. The humor, I think, the way she was using it was almost a, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not going to be Dan Quayle. I'm not going to wind up the punchline of a joke. Mm-hmm. And I think that was effective, frankly.
You know, the self-deprecating part of her humor had a bit of edge to it.
Mm-hmm. Pit bull lipstick.
Exactly. And, yeah. You know, the difference between a pit bull and a hockey mom is lipstick. That I thought was a very significant signal with a smile.
Yeah.
Step back or pay the price.
Yeah.
And I do think that's very interesting. She was known as Sarah Barracuda.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of her rise in Alaska politics. Alaska is bare knuckle politics.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's just fascinating to think about.
But she also told one
means.
Of the news magazines, I've been Miss Congeniality once. I'm not going to be Miss Congeniality again. So
we'll take that at face value. I want to look at the platforms for just a moment. You know, there are incredible differences on abortion and on marriage. Those are the best-known things, and because they are the best-known things, I'm not going to dwell on them long. You have the Democratic platform making a very clear statement of support for Roe v. Wade, unequivocal, and then after that saying that they also want to affirm a woman's right to carry a woman to child and calling for federal support for women and for children. The Republican platform says, faithful to the first guarantee, the Declaration of Independence, we assert the inherent dignity and sanctity of all human life and affirm that the unborn child is a fundamental individual right to life which cannot be infringed. Well, there you have it. Calls for, basically a very clear definition of a fundamental individual right to life. And a fundamental right, according to constitutional law, is one that cannot be abrogated. So that would mean no abortion. And it's very interesting. It says here very clearly, we will work together to reduce the incidence of abortion, to protect girls from exploitation and statutory rape through a parental notification requirement, and to oppose sex selection abortions. It goes on there. Then you also have issues related to, for instance, climate change, where you have the Democrats very clearly saying we must end the tyranny of oil in our time. I thought it was very interesting. What you're hearing from the Republicans now is everything, all the above. Basically, oil, we need to drill, we need to get more oil, but at the same time we need to recognize the age of oil is over, so clean coal, whatever in the world that is, and going through everything
natural gas,
but wind turbines, mm-hmm. The Republicans are really buying into the T. Boone Pickens plan here. I think that's very interesting. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the things that people might not notice, such as the faith-based programs sections of the two party platforms. Very, very interesting distinction there. I wish we had more time to discuss everything in these two platforms, but because we do not, that's why I want to refer listeners of this program to our website. We'll give you the link there to the Christianity Today good work of editing the distinctions between these two party platforms. This is an important conversation. I hope you're having a conversation something like this with your children around the dinner table. I hope you're having a good, informed conversation with the people at your workplace, on your college campus, in the dorm. This is the kind of stuff you ought to be talking about. Don't be afraid of the debate. Don't be afraid of the controversy. Don't be afraid to be thinking on your feet as you're trying to think through these things together. Let's be determined, most of all, to do our best to think like Christians. Back in just a moment. I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. In final moments here, talking with Russell Moore, I want to direct us again to the platforms. And if I could implore you, the listeners of this program, to do any one thing, it would be to go and actually read these platforms and read both party platforms. Don't just take what I read as excerpts. Go and read it for yourself. Don't just take even what Christianity Today provides as a very excellent resource here, but go look at them yourself. We'll put up the links to both party platforms so that you can look at them and print them out. But, for instance, here's something a lot of people wouldn't be looking at. Under the sections that deal with faith-based programs, and we've talked about those programs, I have my own concerns about how that is done and regulated. The Democratic platform says this. At the same time, after saying that they wanted to endorse certain faith-based programs. It says, at the same time, we can ensure that these partnerships do not endanger First Amendment protections and that public funds are not used to proselytize or discriminate. We'll also ensure that taxpayer dollars are only used on programs that actually work. It's the proselytize and discriminate there. Russ, what's going on? We know what's going on there.
It means that you're going to fund faith-based initiatives that aren't faith-based. You're going to have a part there that's going to be essentially just a government program, which saps out the very reason why they're effective in the first place.
And on discrimination, what it means is that if your Christian organization is receiving these funds, then you can't hire only Christians.
Right, that's right.
Or you couldn't not hire someone who, for instance, on moral grounds, would be in a lifestyle you consider incompatible. And so at that point, again, you just have to go back to the original concern I have about the whole faith-based system. And so I say a pox on both parties
on
this
too.
One. We should take none of this tax money. We should stay far away from these programs. And inevitably, the Democrats are going to win on this one. They'll win in the courts if they don't
win
the election.
That's exactly right. And it's turning clergymen into community organizers, and that just doesn't work in doing the very thing these organizations are trying to do.
Now, you see, I thought one of my goals in this program was to have an entire conversation without the words community organizer. And there it came without warning. Last night it was interesting to hear that thing come up again and again. And this is what's going to happen in the course of the next, say, 70 days. You're going to have an awful lot of Americans start to look closer at the biography of all four of these candidates.
Yeah, sure.
And there are going to be some ample opportunities. And we do not want this program to be stuck in the mode of having these conversations just about the election. It is important, but it's not the only important thing going out there. But you're going to have two big presidential debates. You're going to have one very important vice presidential debate. There are going to be all kinds of issues that will emerge. And folks who right now think that this race is over, folks, buckle your seatbelts. We're in for a long ride till November the 4th. Russ, what are your final thoughts?
I think it's going to be interesting to see the kind of vision John McCain lays out tonight. I'm going to be waiting to see if he mentions the unborn in his speech, and I hope so.
Yeah, because it's up to him tonight to actually put the point on the emphasis of this campaign and to tell us why he's running for president in a way that really speaks to the American people. We'll find out what he does tonight. We'll be watching with you and back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.